Well, howdy, folks, and welcome back to another episode of Meta Ideological Politics. Today, I'm here with Ashley Colby. She is the founder and instructor at the Rhizoma Field School in Uruguay, which is awesome. You have a PhD in environmental sociology from Washington State University, I understand?
Yep.
And you're also the, I guess, co-host of the Doomer Optimist podcast with my friend Jason Snyder. So really excited to have you on, Ashley. And I think there's a lot of interesting topics we can touch on. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, nice. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's jump right in. And I want to hear about a lot of things, but I want to hear about the school that you have in Uruguay. It sounds really cool. And a lot of the work that you do in terms of like local community building. Now, I think the primary way that you do this is through agriculture and kind of regenerative philosophy and so forth. But that's certainly of core interest to us on this podcast, right? Is how do we also get out of the abstract and the theoretical and really do tangible on the ground work to make the community stronger and more resilient and making the world a better place that way. So just tell us, what is the Rhizoma Field School?
Okay, so I do have to say a little bit of backstory to get us there. So I did my dissertation research in Chicago, interviewing people who did what I called subsistence food production. So at least 50% of their own food they produce themselves somehow, not just gardens, but hunting, fishing, you know, chickens. And in some cases, people had like small livestock in the city. Through that process, doing those interviews, I basically realized that this sort of small scale production culture is a way that has really, really strong potential community building power. It's practical, it's hands-on, it's fun, but also it necessarily builds community. I mean, people who start getting involved in the act of production in some way or another, not just food, but other things, they troubleshoot. They learn from people, they share resources, you know, they have to reach out to find materials and to solve problems. So taking that insight, I halfway before I even finished and defended my dissertation, I moved with my family to Uruguay. And I thought, you know, basically, I would like to take some of the insights from my dissertation research and my studies of environmental sociology and see if I can host students on study abroad trips, but doing hands-on the field work alongside people who do small-scale production here in Uruguay. And basically the pedagogical approach is more or less, I was just talking with a friend about this the other day, I intuitively didn't tell the students in advance a lot about what to expect, which I think is actually key to the experiential learning, to go in without too many expectations. It's almost like upending the approach of education or even travel as consumer. Like, I want to know exactly what it's going to be like, and I want to have that experience. I want to take the selfie in front of the thing, as opposed to go in with an open mind. I don't really know what to expect. I'm just going to go and do, you know, some volunteer work and see how it goes. So the students come when we have student groups, and we're gearing up to organize more trips now. When the students come, basically I welcome them. I'm an American trained sociologist, so I've worked with undergrads before, so I can like help them and orient themselves. What are we doing here? What's the population we're working with? Like the first day they show up, we bring them over to our friends' farms, like small scale farms. They're our friends. We're in this community. We're part of it. And I ask my friends, like, you know, put together some projects you would like these American students to work on that are like zero skill projects, you know, because they a lot of come in without any skills. And the students just get to work, and they don't really even know why they're doing what they're doing. They're just starting to do it. And then the questions start forming. Why am I pulling weeds by hand? Like, why don't they have a tractor? Why did they plant the rows in this direction? like, why are there fruit trees interspersed in the garden? How do the chickens work? How does watering work? And all these questions start to arise about the system that they're seeing and the work that they're doing. And then I sort of explain, you know, at the end of the day, when they ask these questions, the answers to these questions, but through like the lens of somebody who can speak to undergrads, you know, and speak their language, you know, this is why they do it this way. And they're trying to, you know, avoid the worst effects of agrochemicals by doing it by hand. And it's more labor intensive, but it's, you know, it's really regenerative for the world and this kind of thing. The students at least how they've reported back to us, we've had 5 student groups. They just really are transformed at the end of like 10 days, you know, just thinking about what's possible, but that, you know, the actions of the world, I think a lot of students are told, we change the world top down, you know, we change the world through appealing to politicians. And not that that's not possible, but I just think like a much faster and more controlled route to get there is bottom up. I mean, just do the thing you want to see more of, and more people doing the thing we want to see more of will make that thing exist, you know? So I the pedagogical approach sort of ties in with the research and the theory of social change and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. So much to dig into there. And it sounds like what you do is the students, they just jump right in, right? You just start getting to work. You just start doing things, and through action, right, through these kind of service projects, you directly learn about the ecosystem, the environment that you're ensconced in directly, right? But I'm curious though, like, is there any kind of theoretical part to this too? And I'm curious what frameworks you might use specifically when it comes to like agriculture, regenerative design, and so forth, do you draw on? And I've studied a lot of these various methodologies and actually used to teach them in Hawaii. So I'm curious what schools of thought do you draw from in terms of your understanding of agriculture, ecosystems, et cetera?
Yeah, so basically my approach is like more as a sociologist studying the mind, but doing like ethnography with different populations who do the agriculture, do some sort of alternative, sustainable, regenerative agriculture. So in Chicago, their approach, a lot of people's approach is influenced heavily by like permaculture and organic, those terms, as opposed to here in Uruguay, there's a whole sort of strain of thinking about agriculture that's like about indigeneity and resistance to capitalism, and they call regenerative agriculture the Voisin method, which is like the original French guy who started talking about this rotational grazing system. They also have this culture of like the pampas and the gauchos and you know, cowboy culture here, but you know, like a people being connected to their environment through like managing cattle and this kind of thing. So the way I approach the agriculture isn't as much like assessing how good they're doing, but instead just like I would like to foment more experimentation. I want to accelerate more people doing this kind of work and learning as they go. And my sense is that if you're doing small scale agriculture, when you're close to the land, guided by a certain set of principles, but not just the principles, you're guided also by the results on the landscape and the ecology. And you can't ignore the ecology when you're that in it, you know? In that case, we just need more people doing that, because it, from what I can tell, when people are that close to the land, I talked about this in my book, I called it ecological embeddedness. It's like they are living from this piece of land. They want to take care of it. They don't want to poison it. You know, it's like they're producing their livelihood from it. They care about it necessarily, I think. And so, yeah, I know a lot about a lot of different approaches to agriculture. But I'm kind of agnostic about the nitty gritty of each type of like regenerative versus, you know, rotational grazing versus permaculture versus all of it, I think is we need a lot more of. And I think it would just be great if most people were doing some kind of experimentation in that, even if it's just like backyard gardens.
Totally agree. Yeah, that's very much the approach we take on this podcast, and really it's in regards to political ideology, but I think the same goes for agricultural frameworks, right? Like thinking about permaculture and really grokking insights about design, like how do we design ecosystems and to maximize the functionality of these different micro niches and harness the edge and create a yield, right? It's a whole way of thinking about kind of macro scale designing of agricultural spaces and so forth, right? Then there's like grow bio intensive. I don't know if you heard of it, right? It's down to really the nitty gritty of like, what kind of watering can do you use to water the seedlings and what kind of box, right? Like really specific instructions. And then there's like, I don't know if you heard of Korean natural farming.
No.
It's based on Fukuoka's Japanese process farming, One Straw Revolution, but Korean natural farming was really big in Hawaii, where it's all about basically creating these kind of probiotic tonics for the earth and for the soil microbiology.
Ah, cool.
And the evidence on it is a little shaky. I think there's a lot of like hocus pocus in it, but the idea is pretty cool, right? So there's all these...
You know what else is like that? Biodynamic farming.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that at all?
Oh, yeah.
I stayed at a farm in Italy once where they did that. And like some of it was like, oh yeah, this is so obvious. Like you want to have a cover crop and you want to do this. And then other ones were like, you need to bury a cow horn in the moonlight and stuff like that, like at the full moon or something like that. And I was like, I mean, I'm agnostic about that stuff. I mean, if it gets you onto the land and gets you, you know, doing something different and trying to tap into like ritual and culture and like human natural co-creation is culture. I mean, that's what it is. So I think like that, I was just talking to somebody the other day about there's like this ancient Etruscan way to plant wine grapes on a laurel tree as the scaffolding for it. And they have like this symbiotic relationship. So I feel like there is that basically everywhere in the world, people have co-created with nature to make gardens and, you know, food happen. So I just think like, yeah, whatever you can do. The other thing I wanted to mention that I didn't mention is agroecology is a big word in Latin America. And it's like, I would say the Latin American term that's as popular as permaculture in North America. And agroecology is basically like, you know, doing agriculture in a way that increases ecological health and social health. And so that's just another framework that people use here, agroecología, they call it. And they just think a lot about cyclical waste cycles and using, I think it's similar principles as everywhere, using managed landscapes like fruit and nut trees in conjunction with the garden, in conjunction with livestock, in like a human-made mini farm ecosystem is like the idea, basically.
Totally. Yeah, I want to hear how this method and all these things we're talking about fits into your larger paradigm or philosophy of social change. And you know, on other podcasts, I've heard you get into a little bit about politics and thinking about global scale, big picture issues, right? That maybe you address on like the Doomer Optimist podcast. And I'm curious how you see all of this really local community building, regenerative agriculture stuff fitting into this larger vision that you hold personally of social transformation.
Yeah. So I had like another little story, background story that maybe got me onto this path. In 2008, I think it was, I was interning at an organization in Berkeley called International Rivers. And their explicit goal, and they've been around since the 70s, is to stop dams from being built. And I started interning there and like helping them, you know, just move paperwork around and stuff. And they had like, I don't know, a dozen full-time staff or something like that. So they're getting funding for all these staff members. And it was like a big office and had been around a long time. And like, while I'm doing some, you know, intern grunt work, I was like, so how many dams have you stopped from being built? And they were like, oh, none. And like their explicit goal is advocacy for rivers, but they had zero measurable change over the course of their existence. And it's just because, in my opinion, like the weight of the material world is so strong, like, you know, a small group trying to change things at that scale, at that level, like, you know, are these 12 people in Berkeley going to take on like the governments of China and the US and who are building dams? It's like, it's just, it's David and Goliath. And I just think like a lot of times people get into that kind of work because they want to do good. And then they spend their whole life just like sort of telling themselves that they're doing good work, despite failing at the explicit goal that they're trying to set. So like, I don't know, sort of shook by that experience, I just started thinking about different ways to make social change. And I think it's maybe slightly anarchic of me, but I think, you know, just sort of make the change you want to see if you want to make that change. I also think there's something quite dangerous about specifically trying to target the national or international level, in terms of having cascading effects, unintended consequences. So for example, like a lot of climate change activists say something like, you know, we just need to ban fossil fuels. And it's like, I mean, everything about our lives run on fossil fuels. Like we need to build a system without the fossil fuels before you just take it away. You know, there is like a dialectic here where you actually do need to create the next system before pulling the plug on the one. And you can't just pull the plug. It takes time to create the next system. So it's actually quite dangerous and hubristic to try to pull the plug and just set a policy that has potential cascading unintended consequences. And so I feel pretty strongly that the approach has got to be sort of making the world we want to see bit by bit. And I think that means things like building alternative education institutions. Sometimes it starts like, you know, people are homeschooling and then they turn into little co-ops, and then those co-ops turn into schools run by parents, and then they turn into real schools. You know, alternative economies, localized economies. But I just caveat that by saying like, what this one theory I love and always talk about is called dual process theory by one of my favorite authors, Morris Berman. And basically he just says like, when any civilization collapses, people stop being able to access the normal things that they were able to access when the civilization was functioning. So like food or water or sanitation or transportation, those things, those systems start breaking down. And as they break down, people don't just like roll over and die. They do something. They find some solution to it. That maybe the state, the civilizational state doesn't provide that anymore. But then they work around it. They come up with something else. And all those little ways in which they work around the failures of the system then form into the next system. And so, so I basically think what we're doing now is responding to the failures, coming up with new things, seeing which of those new things work. And then, you know, it's just like this crazy process of experimentation. And nobody knows really what the next system will look like. But the thing that I'm always trying to hammer home is this John Michael Greer quote, because he was just on the Doomer Optimism podcast that came out yesterday, collapse now and avoid the rush, which is if you see that you're in a dying civilization, the civilization is breaking down, there are food shortages on the way, you know, try to do something in advance of being forced to try to get a little bit prepared and see the writing on the wall if possible. So that's the main thing I'm trying to proselytize at the moment, is just sort of like, you know, we're going to have to be forced into this experimentation from the failures of the system anyway, so we might as well, you know, do it while it's not so bad yet and experiment and start building that next system so it's more resilient for the shock, you know, if or when bigger shocks come down the line.
Yeah, great. So this is a specific thing I want to explore with you. So it sounds like part of the philosophy that you're espousing, right, which I agree with 100% in terms of really emphasizing local, bottom-up, grassroots, community galvanizing practices that create a new system, a new attractor, before we take draconian measures to reform or transform the current system. I'm curious what kind of obstacles you've experienced might get in the way of effective local action and community building that might emerge from macro scales that might need to be resolved at that scale. So I don't know if you know the Simple guys, but they talk about this thing called destructive global competition. And the generator function of destructive global competition that emerges at the international global scale between race to the bottom competitive dynamics between nation states can only be overcome through their coordination mechanism that they call the SIMPLE, simultaneous policy. And that there's a trickle down effect, right? So that these problems that emerge at a higher scale actually do trickle down and kind of screw up local communities. So one example I wanted to give was, you know, of the theory of comparative advantage, like David Ricardo's comparative advantage, right? So like, given the kind of current neoliberal order that runs on comparative advantage, maybe not even ideologically, but just in terms of game theoretic selection pressures, each nation state or each economy or each community, right, is going to be incentivized to have a very specialized lane of focus in terms of what they're going to produce and what they're going to export and import, even if they have absolute advantage in terms of production of goods over other countries or other economies. The game of comparative advantage will select for those that are specializing in something, and that can create a lot of fragility if there's like a supply chain shock and you have cost push inflation and you can't export things or your economy tanks, you can't import goods or you have inflation because you have a shortage. But at the same time, people are still getting locked into that dominant strategy of specialization. Because if as long as there's free trade in theory, right, both nations will benefit more from comparative advantage, even if one nation has absolute advantage. So given dynamics like that that emerge at the global level, I'm curious how that actually affects communities. Because my thought is like, well, if a community is trying to be as self-sufficient as possible, they would still be perversely incentivized from the larger game theoretic dynamic in the kind of race to the bottom that would cause them to go from a more self-sustaining economy to one that's based on exports and free trade, that niche, right, exactly.
Okay, so I tend to approach this kind of question more from like a historical materialist perspective, in so far as like, I genuinely think like one of the things that guides my like sociological analysis is this quote that people would rather be ruined than changed. They really don't make solutions unless they're forced to. And my sense is, looking at, let's just say, the example of the wheat problem, which is seems to be upcoming for this Northern Hemisphere growing season, with access to wheat coming out of Ukraine and Russia, what seems to be happening is a cascading protectionism. And I think part of the assumption of what you were saying is that market mechanisms would always kind of trump, you know, like people can make the most money and therefore that's what they're going to choose to do. It seems to be playing out now that countries will take protectionist policies before making money, or they'll be mad or at war, or, you know, or at, you know, a propaganda war against a set of countries, and not make the like market economic decision, but instead make the, you know, protect our own people or do trade deals with our ideological allies, right, or, you know, political allies now. So what I think might be happening, I mean, I always think of things in terms of like, you know, lots of fossil fuels. And I just think like the whole globalized economy era, where it is currently so insane what gets shipped internationally and makes not a lot of actual market sense either. Like, I just the other day, someone was posting on Twitter about people shipping headstones across the world, like from China or something, like engraved headstones. It's like, we couldn't find somebody to do that cheaper, the amount of energy it takes to move that weight. So I think probably what's going to happen is there will be cascading protectionism for those kind of market dynamics, and people will be forced to relocalize their production, just, you know, from basic lack of access. So what's happening now, though, is I've noticed a couple of governments, I'm thinking of, I think it's Scotland and maybe Ireland, are like, instead of trying to take up more agroecological or regenerative ag policies. They're just taking off every possible like conservation, farming, agricultural conservation policy, and instead just tilling everything up so that they can make their own wheat kind of thing, which I think will happen and will be like this shock in the short term. But then there's like, then there's limits on fertilizer, which will stop people from being able to plant in that, you know, industrial ag way. And then hopefully that's the point at which people start doing more, you know, regenerative ag and no-till and that kind of stuff. One kind of interesting example that's happening in my life is Uruguay is such a small country. I am coordinating an effort where I'm getting together basically everyone I know, which is it's actually really easy to know people in this country who are like high level people. Everyone I know who does like agroecology, savory method rotational grazing, native fruit, microbrews, sustainable wineries, and I'm getting everybody together for a talk in the end of April, a month from now, to basically talk about global supply chain breakdown and what we can all do to advance these kinds of practices and domestic production of things, you know, with that in mind. So I do think that probably some countries that are like smaller and more agile, like and highly agricultural, like New Zealand and Ireland and Uruguay, will have an easy time pivoting in this world. But I'm not very hopeful for like U.S., Brazil, Argentina kind types, who are very tied into global supply chains and probably will keep up with market mechanisms, like you were saying, before protectionism for a long while, at least as long as they can, I think. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to get in here, because like what was interesting to me, I think we saw this in like, well, I guess in 2016 and 2020, but a lot in 2016, right? Where Bernie Sanders from the left and Trump on the right were both in their respective populist ways advocating for a kind of protectionism, or what's sometimes called like neo-mercantilism, right? Where there was a critique of like free trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP and other these kind of global neoliberal, right? Trade policies that led to outsourcing of jobs and unemployment and decline of the American manufacturing industry and so forth. And so there was kind of from the left and the right kind of a rising populist nationalist protectionist sentiment, although taking different flavors and different forms.
Right.
So I guess my question though is, in an ideal world, because you're talking about food production, I'm wondering though about what the global supply chain future is of like non-food. So the example I have is like, you know, about in probably, you know, like in the like the 80s, right? Latin American countries, it's something called import substitution industrialization.
I don't know about this.
Okay. So for example, like Brazil in the 80s had hardcore protectionist policies against digital and like computer imports, because they were trying to develop their own national computer industry. But it turns out that Brazilian computer engineers were not as good as the rest of the world combined. And so their computer industry lagged decades behind other countries, and that slowed down their entire economy for decades to come because they're using inferior computer technology. So to me, it's a kind of a catch-22 of like, yeah, we want local, resilient, self-sustaining communities in, you know, and not to mention the carbon footprint of transporting all these things across the ocean and all the ecological ramifications of global free trade. But at the same time, the community or nation could actually end up worse off when other people from another place could produce a good cheaper and more effectively than you can yourself. So I'm wondering how we kind of think about that paradox.
I think about that a lot. And there's a guy on Twitter, his handle's Empty America, who talks about this in like a really straightforward way. He doesn't have like an ideological bent at all. I like that, because, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, romanticize local economies with like rose-colored glasses and don't think practically about what probably will happen. He argues, and I think he's right, you know, globalized trade existed before fossil fuels. And, you know, people want saffron. They're going to do whatever it takes to get their saffron. Now it's like people want microchips. They're going to do whatever it takes to get their microchips. My sense is that things are just so far in an absolutely absurdly ridiculous direction for the most basic goods to live that needs to dial back and is going to dial back. And that's what makes me nervous, because it's actually the most necessary goods for life. Like, we actually do need food more than computers that are the most like at risk here. Although, you know, increasingly like chip shortages for cars and stuff like that are an issue. I personally think it's like probably okay even to have an economy that in which certain high value things are shipped internationally. And, you know, there is an open marketplace still for especially technology, where the whole world gets to innovate together. But commodities and like basic goods for life, I mean, tombstones, like, you know, somebody was posting, all this environmental sociologists, they always have a class where they talk about this, and challenge students to like say, find the most ridiculous supply chain things. I think there's like a trade between two different European countries where they just like ship butter cookies to each other. It's like, we don't need to be, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just so far in that direction that we need, we've just commodified all food, commodified all goods to the point that everything is just a cog in an industrial supply chain. And if there's any interruption in the just-in-time system, it has cascading effects, like for real goods and especially things like food, but other goods that people really just can't get. So for me, I think protectionism, or at least, yeah, I mean, protectionism on things that are necessary for daily life, and then, you know, more open globalized market for, you know, technologies. I don't think we're going back to the Stone Ages. I think it's fine. But yeah, I think, just much, just dial in this direction, you know, dial it back quite a bit.
Wait, I want to kind of counter everything I just said and kind of provide a positive potential outcome or positive unintended effect of protectionism or localism. And so one example would be that if what can be exported is drastically limited, that could actually spur some kind of innovation on part of the community. So what happened in Japan was, I don't know if you know the story about how the Lexus, or like these high-end luxury Japanese cars, were created. The Japanese government did something called voluntary export constraints, where they constrained the amount of cars they would ship to the United States. And so because of that policy, all these Japanese car companies like Toyota and so forth, said, well, we can't ship as many cars, so we have to innovate and create more expensive, better quality cars and ship fewer of those so we can still make money. Nice. Right? So in complexity theory, this is called an innovative or emergent constraint. Right? It's like you can have a constraint on something, and then that will force the community to innovate in ways that they would have not otherwise, because they're reliant on other people's imports or exporting their own stuff. Right?
I love that. And, you know, and I also, like, I don't know enough about, I think maybe the rise up to the globalized economy to like speculate, but I can imagine company towns coming rising up again in the U.S. I mean, the economy right now is so dematerialized. It would be very nice to do some sort of, you know, rebirth of manufacturing, but maybe a potentially craft culture manufacturing. I'm thinking of when I lived in Chicago, there's this neighborhood called Pullman, which was basically a company town built by this railroad magnate Pullman. And he basically built a factory in the middle, and then he built housing for all the workers, you know, emanating out, walkable from the factory. It would be cool to have a new resurgence of, you know, this is the town that makes this thing, and we make the highest quality this thing, whatever it is, you know, train cars, let's get rail going again, in the world, and we do it through craftsmanship and this kind of thing. You know, I don't think it has to go back to even several centuries ago. I think, you know, we could manufacture other things too, but I think just like what you're saying, it would be part of my vision for local economies is this, I think, getting back to like manufacturing real goods, and ideally in a sustainable craft artisan way. You know, I think a lot of leftists and socialists don't think about the like environment at all. And they just think like, we just need industry, and then we need to We need to have unions, and then those unions like put limits on the worst environmental damage. And I think we truly do need to think what we mean by industry, what kind of industry, what kind of economy, you know, what kind of acts of production. And this gets back to the food and ag stuff, but you can make things regeneratively, like most things you can make regeneratively. You could make in a system that is non-harmful to the earth. I truly believe that. So I think just trying to take that approach to every single thing, like, is there a way to make this thing in a way that's beneficial to the earth? And if there is, we should be at least trying to get as close as we can to that, as opposed to like the least bad manufacturing, or like, you know, banned greenwashing on, this is a circular economy thing, and it's just like straight industrial, like crap, you know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah, I had kind of a bizarre thought as you were talking, because I think both of us, right, and I've heard you talk about this like on Jim Rutt's podcast, are against like ideological fundamentalism, right? Like the entire premise of this podcast, Meta Ideological Politics, is about overcoming ideological fundamentalism, or the kind of unwavering commitment to a single ideological frame through which you strain all of reality through, and that does violence. I call it a complexity injustice, right? You do violence to the nature of reality by being so reductive in your kind of ideological monocropped lens, right?
Yeah.
But the protectionism thing is interesting too, because it's like part of the argument, kind of the game theoretic economic argument, is that people will be perversely economically incentivized to do the environmentally bad thing in order to make money. Yeah. But if people have enough ideological fervor to overcome that, that could actually work as a first step towards like, hey, this might actually hurt me economically, but I'm so ideologically committed to it, screw it. It's like that fundamentalist religious attitude, in this case, towards something good, will actually overpower economic self-interest, right?
Well, yeah, this is the thing that I'm always thinking about, is basically, I honestly think that people are more, their psychology is more influenced by their material circumstances than their like willing their psychology into existence. I think a lot of people think you can just like think their way into something different. I keep thinking about what circumstances could we set up that sort of force people to make the right choice. And I think this is why I'm always on about homesteading. In my research, for example, like basically I found that when you get into homesteading and small scale production in your backyard, like I was saying, ecological embeddedness, people make the right choice because it's in front of them. They're confronted by it. And I imagine if you had localized economy and localized manufacturing that was like sort of community based, not like a global, you know, international corporation that's just fenced off on the outskirts of town, but instead like the manufacturing is part of the community, I imagine you make a better choice. Industrial production is horrifying. It's viscerally horrible. Anytime you see anything made industrially, it's aesthetically bad. So I imagine if you made the circumstances such that, you know, people were sort of confronted with the reality of it, and got to make choices about how manufacturing got made, we're making a local economy anew, and we get to make these choices. I try to think about that. Like, do we get forced into a circumstance where like we're confronted with the reality, make the choice or not? I also think in terms of like things like industrial ag, a lot of people go to regenerative from industrial because the system's just failing. Like their industrial system of agriculture is just, it just doesn't work. They're not getting any yields. And so I think about that, like failure as the door opener for like something really beautiful to emerge, which is kind of like basically the doomer optimism, you know, theme, is just failure as an opportunity. We don't want the system to keep going. We want it to fail. And out of that failure comes potentially better things, ideally.
Hopefully people can be equipped with the resources and skills and knowledge to be able to shift into this new way, mode of being and new system. So they're not totally screwed or, you know, kind of left floundering and not knowing what to do when the system does collapse. Yeah. So I'm wondering if we can kind of get into the nitty gritty of like thinking about like community building and like kind of design principles. And I'll share with you how I think of these issues, right? There's an approach called the oblique approach to community development and social change. That's contrasted with the direct approach, right? So the oblique approach is tackling a problem indirectly by not explicitly highlighting that we're trying to fix this problem, but what I call the positive externalities or positive ripple effects that arise from this endeavor or from this intervention indirectly solve the problem that you're trying to solve. So like one way I've thought, one thing I really appreciated from permaculture is this idea of stacking functions, right? So in evolutionary biology, it's called exaptation. So exaptation is very similar to stacking functions, where an organism will, traits of an organism will evolve for a new purpose or for or in a new context. Kind of like when dinosaurs grew feathers to keep them warm, and then that became repurposed for flying when they became evolved to birds, right? So it's like you have something and then it can be repurposed for a different thing. And so the more functions you can stack, the more adaptive you are to the changing circumstances in the environment. So one thing I think about is like how can we design for the emergence of positive externalities through exaptation and stacking functions to address all these other issues that people might be explicitly against if you say that we're trying to address this head on. But if you do it indirectly, it solves a problem. And I use this approach in my work in, professionally, I work in the field of counterterrorism and violence, de-radicalization, and extremism, ideological extremism in Portland. And this is really the only way, in my opinion, to address issues like this. Because you can't go to a bunch of like Proud Boys and Antifa members and be like, I think you guys should be less violent, right? You have to do it.
What do you do? I'm so curious.
This is one of those things where it's like, I'm almost hesitant to share this on the podcast. But it's basically
only say it obliquely, you know, as obliquely as you need to.
Sure. So my whole thing is working with people on their own terms. So what my job is for anything that I do is to study and really steal them out of the hell out of anyone's ideology or worldview, find where there are ideological holes or openings for positive seeds to be planted, that and creating programs, creating internal selection pressures, et cetera. Maybe some subtle forms of mimetic warfare that seem to initially align with people's ideological goals, but will have an unintended second or third order effect that might undermine the negative parts of what they're doing and galvanize them towards something better.
Yes. Okay. So I was just talking with, do you know this Jonathan Rowson?
Yeah.
Okay. So on this liminal web call, and I'm like a total newbie to the liminal web, but I was talking about, you know, planting potatoes or keeping chickens. And I think what happens is a lot of people see that as like silly. They don't see it as directly solving the problem of like meaning and the economy and, you know, politics and all of this stuff. But what I found in my research is that people started to get into self-production because they felt like alienation, let's just say broadly, alienation. But that took the form of them saying something, this is me as a sociologist saying alienation. But what they said to me was something along the lines of, I don't trust the food in the store. Like, I don't trust that I can get food if there's a disaster. I don't trust corporations to label things correctly. So this general sense of like, I don't trust that the food system is like going to be there for me. So I'm going to make my own and then I'll just know those things. What I found though, is that after people started self-producing, they not only reported this like much deeper connection to nature, because you have to pay attention to nature in order to produce anything, including hunting and fishing. You have to be attuned to the system, to the ecosystem, to how everything works. So they felt a connection to nature. People were like reporting that in their garden, it went from like one species of bee to 30 species of bee over, you know, three gardening seasons and noticing all the different types of bee. Okay. They didn't go into growing food to increase biodiversity and their awareness of it, but that was a side effect. They started to build community. People rallied around their chickens in Chicago because there was a city council person, they call them aldermen in Chicago, who was threatening to ban chickens, and they've been legal basically the whole history of the city. And everybody rallied, and all the chicken people got together, and they got this they had this Chicago chicken coop tour, and then they started showing their coops to all their neighbors. And then the kids came in and were like, oh my gosh, chickens, this is so fun. And they sort of like build the soft power social capital from, you know, just this simple activity that they didn't intend to like, you know, make a political statement or like, I'm going to keep chickens so that I meet my neighbors. But it was like this side effect. And then finally, a lot of people who started growing their own food had like surpluses of some things and not enough of other things. So then they started bartering. Like there was a guy who kept like just a huge amount of poultry in his backyard, and he had like poultry manure, and he traded that to this lady who had like a plot in a community garden who wanted extra compost. With, you know, you compost the manure and turn it's excellent compost in return for vegetables, this kind of thing. They're like building out informal economies. I mean, true informal economies that like could potentially make the difference for them if there was a disaster and they didn't have, there wasn't, you know, eggs in the store, but they know that they have their egg hookup. it's one of those things where I personally think there are certain activities that have cascading like oblique effects that are completely under discussed. And I think what happens is people get into a trap where they think like, yeah, chickens aren't enough to solve climate change. What we need is like a UN delegation on fossil fuels. And I'm like, you know, but, you know, I think the whole idea is we do need to make a whole different system. And it might sound silly, but like starting with the act of self-production, and it doesn't just have to be food. It can be like crafts. It can be furniture. You can start to build things for yourself. You can learn masonry. You can learn other skills. Something shifts. That's not just the material thing. Something shifts in your relation to nature and to the world and to community that like, I think that absolutely has cascading effects. So yeah, I think about that too. The other thing is that's related to what you were saying. People are really connected to something like food growing in a garden, or keeping chickens or hunting. There's a reason there are like hunting clubs. It's a joyful and fun thing when you get in. It's exhilarating. It's an exhilarating thing. It makes you feel alive. It makes you feel meaning. I think there are inherently some things that people like that are very meaningful to them. And so what you think, you talking about like getting into the ideology of some of the you know, terrorist ideologies. I also think that there are ways to approach this that are not even talking, they're doing. And that's the thing I keep, like part of the reason I have the field school, how it is, and I don't really tell people in advance, you know, I'm not telling them ideologically, like, this is why agroecology is the best thing in the world. Instead, they're just doing it. And from the embodied experience of it, they're like, wow, this is so great. See the sun, you know, move through the sky throughout the day. The kids are running around in the garden. Their hands are dirty. They feel tired, but like good, you know. There is something that cannot be explained in some instances about experiences that can change your psychology potentially, like, you know, much more than just talking to change ideology. Not to say that talking isn't useful too. I just think a lot of people go to talking first as opposed to you know, potentially shifting somebody's total experience and then that changing the way they think. The final comment I'll make on that is I saw this tweet once where somebody was describing this like war-torn region, you know, indigenous culture, I forget where they were talking about after this war, the UN sent in like psychologists to help people like manage their PTSD after the war. And the people in this, you know, indigenous community were basically saying like, yeah, they bring us these people to like sit and talk in a room. But we all know that after like tragedy, you dance, you're supposed to dance together with everybody. That's the way you get out of it, out of the funk, the mental funk. And like, that really resonated with me. I think in general, I think we're in our heads too much, and I'm myself included. I'm a modern person, like, you know, I'm on the path to embodiment, but it's, you know, it's like it's a process. But I think like embodied experiences can be really transformative if you find the right ones, you know.
Oh, totally. So what I'll say to that is, I think what you've suggested, right, not getting into the idea space, but just raw embodied shared experience, that is the best way to go. for all, you know, whether it's ideological de-radicalization, whether it's community building, 99% of the time, right? Depolarization, this data shows that this is the most effective way. I think what I was getting at was there are niche situations where people's ideologies are so eccentric and extreme that something that we would think is completely innocuous, like we're just going to go and dance, is seen as an ideological threat to them. My job of understanding where they're coming from is to frame these activities in the way that's compatible with them.
That makes sense. And I think that I probably don't have as much experience dealing with such niche psychological, you know, states that I would have to even think through that problem. But I think in general, I'm probably still on the same spectrum where, like, when I talk to American undergrads, I'm thinking about, you know, their ideology, which is like consumerism and success looks like this and environmental solutions look like solar panels and Teslas. And, you know, that it's a kind of ideology itself, and thinking about trying to meet them where they're at and not make them feel bad or guilty for holding this like very common mainstream American ideology, and instead just playing up the parts of their experience here that are joyful and lovely, and how they can bring that into their lives. I think it's similar. It's a compatible, you know, skill set. And I think, yeah, when I talk about how I help them integrate in the evening when they're asking questions, that's always on my mind, you know, balancing. I don't want to like put too much judgment on their lives as they are, but also playing up the ways in which they could change, the different approaches that resonate. Totally, I think it's a similar skill set. And that talking after the experience does make a difference in their integration. It's not just the experience, like the talking and making sense of it. It's almost like, I don't know if you follow like psychedelic therapy, but there are lots of, you know, obviously this, there, it's becoming more mainstream. And you know, best practices is like the experience and then the integration period after is better than just the experience. And then now you're out into the world and good luck with figuring out what that meant, you know, but instead like, yeah, making sense of it. And we have to like make stories looking back about who we are and that we're not bad people, I think. So thinking about that, like you're a good person, like in some cases you're a victim of circumstance, but there are other options, and like that's not a judgment on your past life. I think that's something I encounter a lot, is people get defensive if you say like, yeah, having a garden is nice and chickens, they're like, well, I can't do that, and why are you judging me, and that kind of thing. So you have to be delicate with those things, I think.
Yeah, and when you were talking about the chicken experiment in Chicago, right, I was thinking like Nomasnobu Fukuoka calls it the one straw revolution. This is the one chicken revolution, right? Like it all starts with the chicken and the cascading really effects of that, right? You gain so much momentum.
I know, but then like a lot of people, the thing that it's been driving me crazy lately is a lot of people, like I still do research and publish in environmental sociology, and I'm on the board of an organization that's like a sustainable consumption research group and research network. And basically people are like screaming at the top of their lungs, like, we need change, we need action. And the other day, like a month ago, I went in and like, so I do this type of teaching that is like bringing people out into the world and experiencing practitioners who are doing things, producing things sustainably. And I basically said to the listserv, like, any of you who teach undergraduates could go out into the world and have a class where you spent some time with practitioners to see what they do. And a bunch of people wrote back, oh no, we need administrators to like make those programs available, or we need, you know, we need this or that, we need like a policy at a federal level and blah, blah, blah. It's like, it's very frustrating to me that there is a class of people who literally says they want action. And when you give them an example of something that they could do, they're like, it's not big enough. It has to be at a higher scale, you know? So then it's this cyclical excuse making thing, like it's not a big enough scale to make a difference. They don't see like the potential scaling up effect from the bottom. Like if everyone on this listserv who teaches environment started incorporating field experiences into their curriculum, and students will love that, administrators will take note and then other schools will pick up on it. It's like so obvious the way it scales, but they think it's just silly. It's not big enough if it's just them doing it. They want to be told like everybody has to do it, kind of thing. And I've been really frustrated with that perspective lately. I don't know if you encounter that at all.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there are several things going on there, right? One is it makes me wonder what their goals actually are.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is I wonder, is it just an issue of people not really understanding complex systems or how bottom-up change works or how cascading ripple effects impact the system, right? I love the quote in complexity theory of the agent in the complex system controls nothing, influences everything.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's like, what is the aggregate of all of our individual actions, right? What is this all going to amount to? What kind of emergent effects is this going to create? And the studies show, right, like people are really bad at thinking systemically and at scale and thinking about the ramifications, positive or negative, of what they're doing.
Right.
So I don't know if that's like an education issue or if it's more just like making these actions and behaviors really fun and appealing. So that even if I believe climate change is a hoax, as long as I'm acting as if it's a threat, then I'm addressing climate change, right? Like I don't even need to, technically, I don't even need to believe in climate change. I just need to live a sustainable lifestyle or regenerative lifestyle, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is like, okay, so on the climate change issue, something I wrote a paper about in the journal Environmental Sociology was in my data, I interviewed people in Chicago and in the suburbs and in the rural area. In the rural area, a lot of it was like conventional farmers who like hunted and had gardens, and like their gardens were like pristine organic, and then they're like just conventional producers because that was their job. And a lot of those people who I interviewed had like what I call like a super strong ecological ethic, but did not believe in climate change. They thought climate change was a hoax, and they were like, basically Fox News says like this is like a Democrat, funded hoax. At the same time, they cared a lot about like, more and more the soil quality. This one guy I interviewed went fishing, and he's like talking about how fish life cycles, people are overfishing, the fish aren't able to get to maturity anymore how they used to. There's like all this pollution getting dumped by fishing vessels. He was talking about like the ecological ethic of like making sure you take an appropriate amount of deer when you go hunting. Caring about biodiversity and his garden and all this kind of stuff. But he's like, but it's not climate change. And I think that there is a disconnect on the climate change message versus like other ecological indicators like biodiversity, water, soil, this kind of stuff. Whereas I think people get a little too ideologically tied up with the climate change argument if they could get to the same set of practices on water, soil, biodiversity, just go with that. Like, manage your messaging, man. It's like, I think, there is a little bit of like a church of climate change. And there are, even regenerative farmers who do regenerative agriculture who don't necessarily think climate change is the main motivator, or they don't really like care that much about it. They're just like, I just want to make sure my soil quality goes, I want to be able to have a yield. I want to, have good biodiversity on my farm. Like, I don't want things to keep going to shit. I don't want to keep being beholden to the large corporations. We can find common ground. And I think, to me, that's actually a big part of my project is to find common ground and to get that messaging across in ways that make sense to people, that appeals to them. I agree with the goal of increasing biodiversity. I also agree with the goal of lowering carbon use. So if I'm talking to like my environmental sociologist, I'm talking about carbon use. If I'm talking to like farmers, I'm talking about soil health, but I agree with all of it. So I can just pick and choose which to use,
That's awesome. Yeah. I've joked before on this podcast, but I'm very serious about this idea that we need a more holistic version of the invisible hand. Right? So it's like,
wait, Yeah, explain what that means.
Sure. So, you know, like the invisible hand, going back to Adam Smith, classical economic theory, is that people pursuing their own individual economic self-interest will create this emergent property of the invisible hand that benefits everyone, even if you weren't involved in that transaction. So if mediated through a free market system, agents pursuing their own economic self-interest will make the entire system better, right?
Yeah.
And of course, is that true to some degree? Yeah, perhaps. Are there a lot of negative externalities produced by that? Absolutely, yes. That you know, the classical economists didn't account for. So my idea of like a more holistic invisible hand, in this case with the farmers, is like they're pursuing their own self-interest, adopting these regenerative agricultural practices that have macro benefits, right? Their own self-interest, maybe even to gain a competitive advantage by being seen in the community as like the regenerative guy, right? Maybe you're even economically incentivized to that lifestyle, but that creates positive externalities, positive emergent factors that benefit the whole, right? So it's not about getting people necessarily to say, oh, we all need to agree on the same abstract hyper-object that climate change is the problem and then take action accordingly. It's how do we build a system or design incentives where you can take action in your own way that makes sense to you, but that the results of those actions have macro benefit.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, honestly, when it comes to the food system specifically, I don't know if I'm becoming like more free market fundamentalist over my life, because I think when I was in college, it was like the market is the source of all evil, but like, it's so obvious to me that subsidies are the thing that's driving the agricultural market globally. Like it's government's intervention and subsidies that actually is making the incentive structures how they are. I think Vandana Shiva, the Indian activist, posted a chart where I think two of the three main commodities, corn, soy, and wheat, two of the three were negative yield, meaning the amount of money it takes to grow them, the amount they earn is lower than the amount it takes to grow them now, in terms of all the inputs. But the subsidies make up the difference to just make that commodity crop keep getting planted, even though the market says it's not a good thing to do. You know what I mean? So I think more and more, I think market mechanisms, when left alone, do have a better track record at least than the market plus laws written by free marketeer large scale industrial corporations together is much more perverse incentives than just the market itself. It seems to me like, if you were being straightforward about the way commodity crops work now, like almost everybody would abandon it and switch to regen if it weren't subsidized by the government right now.
There's a big problem too. I mean, my favorite example that makes me most pissed off is corn subsidies, right? Why are we feeding cows corn? It's like, it's bad, like for the, like on every level, it's not efficient. Yeah. And it makes so much more sense to just give them grass, right?
Yeah.
But like the subsidies corrupt the incentive structures because politicians and lobbyists, right, are basically gaming the system to benefit their own interests at the expense of the environment or whatever, right?
Yeah. Right.
I think there are ways that certain types of subsidies or certain types of government programs can be better designed. Like my wife would push back on this because she works for the Department of Health and the state of Washington Department of Health, and the farm bill, right, the kind of notorious farm bill does provide a lot of really important benefits for her program, for like SNAP benefits for poor people and like partnering with local grocery stores and stuff. But there's also a whole bunch of really bad stuff in there too. So the whole thing could be cleaned up and I think made better. Or, but I guess my other question too is, to what degree is the lack of mass adoption of regenerative farming practices caused by economic pressures, right? So like what my permaculture teacher used to tell me is just the fact that because they don't enjoy economies of scale, right? Local production, they'll always cost more or have some kind of disadvantage against big ag methods, right?
Right.
Unless of course you're in a community that, again, ideologically values that more, so that trumps economic interests. But there are like economic structural disadvantages, and like how could you know, how could that be supported either positively or by doing something to kind of disempower, you know, big ag, industrial
ag,
etc.
I think about this a lot. Honestly, I went in grad school, went on a tour of like small scale ag producers in the Skagit Valley in Washington. And like the story is over and over again, we just cannot compete with industrial ag. Like their practices, they've got too many subsidies. The whole game is rigged in their favor. For example, like this organic farm told this horror story of like they waited 3 years to become organic, and then they moved a fence post from one side, like a series of fence posts from one side of the farm to another that were adjacent to industrial agricultural land, and then they had to wait the new 3-year waiting period because that's like they need to get back organic certified from having these fence posts there. It was like the whole system is so bureaucratic and set up for industrial ag to do well. But also, I personally think abundant fossil fuels at a like cheap barrels of oil and cheap fertilizer are really the thing that we need to be looking at for these things to change. And they're changing like right now. And that's the thing I've been basically waiting to change because, well, that or soil health. Like if there's a dust bowl, you can't plant. And not that I'm hoping for that, but it's just like the inevitable conclusion of industrial agricultural practices is either fertilizer becomes too expensive, oil becomes too expensive to run everything and distribute it all, or you destroy the ecosystem, you can't grow things anymore. And that's when people start changing. Now, like I said before, I would love it if many more people got into smaller scale ag sooner so that they could then take advantage of economies of scale, like a better distribution for small scale. Like small scale production distribution is a mess. It is such a mess. The amount of time people like spend on dropping off or picking up, or, you know, like there is nothing like the supermarket efficiency, but there's nothing stopping small scale producers from having a supermarket type model, you know, where they just bring it into a centralized location. And then there's a couple employees who run the store and, you know, it's a lot easier for everybody involved, including like seed buying clubs. Where I live in Uruguay, there is an agricultural cooperative where farmers and local community leaders are members, and they get together and talk about like, what do we need to buy? We'll buy it in bulk together. And we have it in the cooperative store. And this is for like all the agricultural producers in our little region. Coordinated efforts like that, that are like civil in nature, they're like a civil organization, but they influence economies of scale, causes it's so much more resilient system than, you know, these like separate little individual producers who are like marketing on their own and trying to find customers on their own. My sense is in the next couple of years, we're in for like a huge system shock in terms of like industrial ag systems failing either global supply chains or like either also industrial production, like domestically, for these different reasons. And then probably what will happen is that people will start building out these economies of scale on regen or smaller scale producers or large scale regenerative producers. But I think it's messy because if you don't like see it coming and plan in advance, you're going to be like forced into a messier outcome than if you plan for in advance and like, you know, plan accordingly for what's inevitable.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it makes me think too, my wife led a program called CSA Partnerships for Health. And this gets back to the acceptation and stacking functions thing where basically she worked with a bunch of local small scale organic farmers in the Portland area and connected them, and they created partnerships with doctors and medical clinics so that doctors can provide organic, really, you know, locally grown CSA vegetable shares to people who had chronic health conditions like diabetes or heart disease. And so it was a way of giving the farmers kind of a market for their product, right? That would normally be outcompeted at the grocery store. But they were given to people, mostly like low income and poor people with chronic health conditions. And then what they would do is they would basically, you know, they would get to CSA. There would be like a little cooking demonstration, the CSA pickup place. And then they would go home and cook it or do it as a community, right? And cook these healthy meals. There are ways, I think there are creative ways to activate these resources for people that can kind of bypass the main system, right? This is, again, the kind of oblique approach, right? So you can kind of create a specific niche for a product or a good that normally wouldn't have a niche if you connected in creative ways, right? Like this. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the thing that I'm always trying to work on is like curating fun experiences. And there's a couple of guys who are out in Oregon who I met on Twitter who are doing a bunch of activities that are like, let's do a farm to table dinner, let's have community activities. There, one guy is starting like a men's group. I think for me, the experiences, if you can curate like that fun experience of cooking together, of having a meal together, there, you know, it's so much more impactful, and people want more of that. And I mean, I think that fundamentally underneath a lot of the things that motivate me is that like people are feeling really devoid of meaning. They're feeling really alienated. They're looking for some meaning. They're looking for purpose. They're looking for connection. And I think there are ways to function stack where you'd get those things and actually build resilient local economies at the same time, and also build community out of it. I encourage anyone who has any extra bandwidth in their life with these things, like, you know, see if you can start a men's group, see if you can get involved in your community garden, or, you know, keep some chickens and start meeting other chicken people, start learning how to weld, whatever it is, whatever kind of thing you get into that's like craft culture, artisan culture related, there's always a group of who do it and have a lot of fun, and you can necessarily build community out of that. And I think that's what I'd encourage people to get into: something tangible, get new experiences, and then, you know, community will follow from that, and lots of meaning too, I think.
Beautiful. That's probably a perfect way to end.
Okay.
Yeah, Ashley, this has been such a pleasure to talk to you. We just went all over the places riffing on these.
No, ideas. That was great. Yeah, that was good. I haven't talked about macroeconomic stuff, so that was fun too, because we're like, Jason and I seem to always be focusing on like the super micro niche stuff. So this was super fun.
Yeah, covering every scale there. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And maybe we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Nice to meet you, Ryan. Have a good one.
You too.